This week on A to Z Running. In further reflection on the topic of goals and finding meaning, we share a compelling lesson from author, speaker, and coach John O'Sullivan's Every Moment Matters. Also, we answer a listener question about the camaraderie or lack of at the Olympic Trials Marathon. In the world of running, indoor track is exploding and records dropped like lead sinkers at Millrose Games. Not to be outdone, there were great performances as well in France. And in a tragic turn, the marathon world record holder has died in an accident. All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we're helping runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching training services. And just a reminder that you can find out everything you need to know about that stuff, what we do and everything else at atozrunning.com. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Spotify for the places where we share the content and the things that we're doing. And we're noticing, by the way, an uptick in listenership on Spotify using the video feature. Yes, Spotify allows you to watch as well as or listen to the podcast. There's an embedded video feature, and we do have video, in case you didn't know that, for our podcast, which is why we're on YouTube as well. But you can find us in the places, interact with us in all of those places, because that's what we like, the interactions. As a matter of fact, as a side note reflection, I'm going to get into this a little bit more in the main topic here soon, but interaction being prime in terms of that's what we like to do most with the kind of stuff that we're doing. It's interesting that the topic today brings up something that I've shared, and a couple of different points the topics today bring up something I've shared recently and throughout the history of our podcast about my own tendencies in terms of interaction, as well as the Olympic Trials event just recently held last weekend, depending on when you're listening to this, and other things. So it's going to be an episode jam-packed with deep reflections on what we are doing and thinking about as runners. I hope that you enjoy it. And lots of fascinating takeaways at that. So make sure that you are commenting on the stuff or sharing your thoughts, because your thoughts are the things that we like to know and see the most in all the stuff that we're doing. And many thanks to those of you who do, in fact, do that, as well as saying hello when we see each other in person, which is just the best of all of it. So with that, we've got a lot to share this week. Some of it's great, some of it is tragic, and we'll get to all of that here, starting with your questions. I should have said this earlier as I'm sitting here talking about interaction and such, and ignoring the obvious fact that Zach is solo today and talking on the podcast. No Andy. She's around. She'll be back soon, as I am want to promise, because I don't want to lose your listenership just because you have to listen to Zach for too long, because you'll get Andy in her dulcet tones shortly. Is that the right word? Dulcet tones? Look me up. I think it is. All right. So let's start with questions. Remember, you can always ask questions by sending an email to questions@atozrunning.com. That's the easiest way to do it. And we'll respond to your questions via email, even if we can't get to them on air on the podcast. We rarely answer more than one, because of time constraints, sometimes two, but we'll still reply via email if we can't get to it on the podcast. So questions@atozrunning.com. Okay, now this one's from Craig, and wanted to share it because it's timely, as well as a really interesting follow-up. We shared last episode a recap of the Olympic Trials Marathon, the United States Olympic Trials Marathon. It was a very exciting experience. We were there, naturally, which is why we were sharing about it, and had lots of incredible things going on around that, which was cool. So if you missed it, you can certainly go back and listen to it. But Craig's question I found to be an interesting one and wanted to share more about it. So here is what Craig wrote. Was it good camaraderie, or did the runners keep to themselves? Simple question, straightforward. So the reason why I want to talk about this in particular and answer your question here, Craig, is because it's actually very fascinating to me. The question itself and the reality of what happens in these things. This concept is really interesting to me. I guess you could say as a kind of like intellectual curiosity, because I don't participate directly, and I'll explain that. That being the case, I don't know that I talked about it in any substantial depth last week when we were sharing the recap, and probably haven't much, but there's some really interesting things going on here. So we're going to share about it here. First, a note about the caveat. I mentioned last week that I personally, with these events, am just like all business, focused on my own stuff or my family stuff and not really interacting much with others. That's more a personality tendency than anything else. Zach tends to have a harder time with the social side of life, both in terms of desire to participate and capacity or ability. But that's not to say I don't enjoy the people. And as a matter of fact, I very much enjoy the experiences of these events and for so many reasons. But I want to get into this topic here, this question rather. So first, a little bit of context and history. My personal experiences with these kinds of events have varied dramatically across all sorts of different types of dynamics. Certainly, I've run on teams. So I've been on like a college team where we're traveling together. We're interacting with other athletes a lot. And I've been on in individual settings where I've gone to race events by myself. Like a good example here would be I once flew out to San Francisco to run in a track meet at Stanford, solo, flew out by myself. Never at any point in time during that meet or the surrounding 3 days that I was in the area did I interact deliberately with anyone for social reasons. So like 3 days in Palo Alto, California, where the only interactions were the necessary ones, like, you know, talking to the people who were giving me my equipment or checking into the hotel, things like that, right? And so I have gone to an event to compete where I did not interact with another human deliberately for social purposes. And contrast that with other experiences where I've been on teams and I've done like the whole thing was with others. It's a, you know, very, very different kind of setting, of course. So let me give you one that's kind of somewhere in the middle. But the previous Olympic trials that I competed in was in 2016 in the Olympic Trials Marathon in Los Angeles. And that one was very unique because as I'm getting on the plane to go to the event, who else happened to be riding on that same flight but Dathan Ritzenhine, who, so we know Dathan because we're from the same area. We've lived in the same area, but also interacting through some of these types of things. And why it's pertinent here is because Dathan's a very kind human being as far as like courteous and it shows in many different contexts in his interactions. But, you know, seeing little old me, Zach, in the airport, he kind of took me under his wing and was like, hey, you know, we can make an experience out of this and show me the ropes a bit, as it were. But so we were flying together. We ended up spending a decent amount of time together for a number of reasons. We were using the same physical therapist to help us in terms of like medical treatment stuff. So he came to the room and we just, you know, all met together. And while he was working on us, we were all hanging out and chatting, things like that. Dathan invited me to join him and some others for one of the meals at one of the times, or maybe it was like, you know, we were just getting like refreshments at one point, but like things like that, right? And so, as it were, because I was around him and he is so connected to this world, I ended up rubbing shoulders with more people and like just socially interacting with other runners, which I never do deliberately on my own, as you can see. So it's revelatory to me as I'm observing these experiences in 2016, that there is a kind of subculture and subgroup within the running world of elite level or high level running world that is itself its own community. And I had never been truly aware of that until that experience, and started to just realize that there is actually like something here that's predictable. And so I'll explain this more. So these runners, for the most part, most elite level, pro level runners spend a fair bit of their running career as single adults either running with a pro team or interacting a fair bit, like involved, connected with some kind of other group, a pro group of runners or a group under the same coach and such. And then in competition, you think about this, you go to these other running events and you're just seeing the same people all the time. And even like, well, let me give you a quick story to illustrate this. At the 2024 trials then here, when I mentioned last week, I'm at the technical meeting and it was an interesting experience, but there's like 200 people, more than 200 people in this room, and the runners plus others who are with them. Here I am sitting kind of near the back, and there was like almost no space left when I got there. And I did not get there late, by the way, but punctual people, these runners. So sitting near the back, and the meeting ends, and I turn around, I stand up out of my chair, turn around, and someone's phone was sitting right behind my chair. And I was like, oh, someone left their phone. I pick it up, and there's some guys back there behind me that were just kind of standing around chatting. And I walk up to them, and I'm like, hey, this phone was just sitting behind the chair back here. Is that any of yours? And they're like, oh, I don't know. And one of the guys just turns around and he says, hey, maybe that's Noah's, because he was sitting right there. And my first thought is, Noah? Who's Noah? Like, how am I supposed... He just suddenly thinks that I know who this person named Noah is. Well, as it turns out, I actually did, because it's a more recognizable runner from my experience watching races and stuff, someone I've seen a lot. And so Noah Drotty, who was sitting near me at the time, and I did notice that he had been sitting there earlier, but Noah Drotty was sitting right there. So I took the phone over to Noah and said, hey, do you know whose phone this is? It was sitting right behind me in the chair there. And he's like, oh, no, maybe it was this guy's, though. And it's some other guy that I've never, I don't know who it is that he's talking about. And so this, like, thing just keeps happening. And then this guy suddenly comes walking up, and everyone's like, oh, hey, this is your phone, right? And they all apparently knew him. And I didn't know a single one of these other runners. So this is going on as just this is revelatory to me of this phenomenon. And it reminded me of those old, so if you've ever run like high school, not run, but participated in any, in like high school sports, college sports, things like that, there's this kind of thing that develops. And so it's like, you know, the rivalry days where like, you know, each other, you don't necessarily really have any personal relationships with a lot of these others, but you compete against each other regularly. Like, think about the conference scene, your high school conference or your college conference, where you compete against these same people fairly regularly throughout the season. And you kind of develop a sense of one another and you interact with each other. And then if you're in the good old setting is like you're at the national championships, and it's like you kind of have a sense of camaraderie with your own conference in opposition to the other conferences. So it's like, I would rather get beat by my conference rival than by the just stranger from this other place. And there's something to that, right? It kind of develops a really interesting camaraderie and community in sense. Well, the elite running scene, especially at the marathon level in particular, as I'm sharing it here, is fascinating in that sense. Because you think about this, there at the Olympic trials this year, there were 200 guys. And really about 100 of them just kind of snuck by, barely qualified, you know, in terms of time standard, I among them. And so if you narrow it down further, there's about 100 guys in that race who are the upper echelon of marathoners in the United States. And if you run any major race, any big race in the country, you're seeing those same people, 15 or 20 of them every time, right? Maybe 10 at the fewest. And so it makes sense. It stands to reason that there's this kind of some kind of sense that develops around each other. And you see it when you go to these events. And that's the best way I can answer your question here, Craig, because you go to that event, and even if you don't know a single person, you're not necessarily part of like the circle, you can see it in manifesting in the interactions. I'm picking up the bottles or decorating the bottles, and people start chatting with each other. And it's like, you know, they don't necessarily know each other a lot of the time, but they've raced each other many times. And it's like Colin McCow. He would never remember who I am, but Colin McCow and I have actually raced each other a lot. He just always beats me. He wouldn't know who I am because he's always up way up ahead. But I see him at a race, and it's like, or at an event like this, it's like, oh, that's Colin. I know who that is. I could walk up and talk to him, except I don't, because that isn't something Zach does. But point is, yes, lots of camaraderie. It's not ubiquitous, but it is definitely, there's a sense of like, we are this thing together, even though we're all individuals and many of us don't ever interact with each other outside of these events and stuff. It's very interesting. Quick bonus, Craig also asked, will you ever run another marathon in 70 plus degree weather? And the reason I'm sharing this is because I appreciate your question, Craig. My answer, however, is just not there's not really an answer to that, because I just run whatever the thing is that fits. And so I don't really pick races dependent on weather or conditions at all. It just so happens that I pretty much only ever race in terms of like marathons, either late spring or late fall. And those tend to be good times weather-wise in the areas where I'm running, but not always. And if it's not, so be it. And if it is, great. And that's about the full amount of thought that I put into it. So, Craig, thank you for your questions. And as always, remember that you can ask your questions anytime by sending an email to questions@A2Z running.com. We look forward to your thoughts and hearing from you, and we'll share our thoughts in response. Now let's get on to something helpful. As promised, this topic is going to be a bit more substance and at the idea and concept level than anything else. I always want everything to be practical. We really try to make sure that anything that we're sharing on the podcast has immediate practical connections for runners. That's why we do it. But every now and then I start thinking about something, and I just want to be able to talk about the idea, and it doesn't always have as apparent a practical connection. Now, that's not me saying this one isn't practical as much as it is just, you know, there's some interesting connections to concepts as runners, and I like to be able to dwell on that from time to time. It also may have a bit of a, well, I shouldn't hedge. I'll let you decide for yourself how you feel about the topic. As it were, this connects further still to some of the reflections after the most recent Olympic trials event, because there's this concept somewhere between goals and expectations and purposes and meaningfulness and such with running that I'm always fascinated by. So I'll share more on how that connects to the Olympic trials in a bit, but there was a particular immediate connection. The point here being, often as we talk about goals on the podcast here, we're often advocating for temperance and moderation in our thinking. Like, it's not really about hitting a time or some kind of performance result, but it's like we got to find something more to aspire toward. But at the same time, I wonder if I'm not sometimes advocating too strongly for one extreme, and isn't it also important to cultivate, you know, a passion for achievement? You think about like when we see interviews with athletes after races, and it's like, you know, my goal was to break the world record. It's like, wow, that's really an aspiration there. But isn't it good that we have people aspiring toward great things? Isn't it good that I want to, you know, achieve a 10-minute personal best in this event because I might be able to qualify for something? Like, yes, I think it is. And I just am going to try to grapple with this a little bit on the episode here. In particular, a very interesting concept that I stumbled upon as I was thinking about this idea, and I was reading in a particular book. I've got it actually right here. If you see this, I'll be sharing a little bit about it. But one aspect in particular just stood out to me suddenly as I was looking at this book, and I wanted to dwell on it a bit with you. So here we go. John O'Sullivan, the author, he is all about creating a healthier sports environment for youth, as well as, you know, certainly adults. And so he's got a lot to say about that dynamic and that subculture. He started an organization called Changing the Game Project in particular to try to address this, and is the author of a number of books. In particular, the one we're sharing here is Every Moment Matters: How the World's Best Coaches Inspire Their Athletes and Build Championship Teams. And in that book, his focal point is lessons, and he has 17 lessons. That's a lot of lessons. So it's also a fairly thick book. You see that if you're watching. I'll keep holding it up. So lots to say about the topic is kind of the point. But one of them immediately stood out to me. I was glancing through the table of contents. I've looked at the book in the past, but it's been a while. Glancing through the table of contents, and I thought, yeah, that's immediately applicable to the thing that's been on my mind. So here's the lesson. It's number 3 in his book, and the text of the lesson is the goal is to win. The purpose is something much deeper. And I thought, now that's interesting. Because of course, it's true. Why do you compete? Well, to win. And so, like, in a race concept, why am I running the race? Well, to achieve something. And there's a lot of different ways we can define that. But in principle, in athletics in general, the competition, the point is to win. And so this teacher, I've often referenced high school teacher in Spring Lake, Michigan, David Tooney, has this line that he says, as he's talking about purpose in education, and he compares it to football. And he's like, okay, so imagine a football team, high school football team, you know, how hard they work and practice, all this stuff. Imagine that they don't ever play a game in a season. What kind of experience would that be like for the high school football team to practice every day and never play a game? Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't do it, right? It just would not happen. And then he also compares it to theater. Imagine a theater troupe or cast who rehearses all the time and never does a performance. Well, that's where we get to, like, the in the essence of, there certainly is more reasons that we run than just that performance at the end. But there's that thing that we're trying to achieve by it. And that, you know, the goal is to win. So I get that. And I realize as I'm reading the text of this, I'm thinking, this is a much more balanced approach than where my thoughts have tended to be lately on the topic. And I'm interested to hear more about it. So I started reading, and I'm going to share with you some of the takeaways here and try to be concise about it. And then I have a kind of a major so what at the end. So the lesson, lesson number three in text is actually a quote, direct quote from Jody Redman, who's a speaker, author, educator, and such. And she's the one who said the goal is to win. The purpose is something much deeper. Great foundational. It clearly got my attention. Well, how many times do we ask this question? And this was from the book. And as I'm reading this, I thought this is really interesting. How many times do we ask, you know, after some kind of event, did you win? Or did you lose? Did you win or lose? How did it go? You know, how did it go means did you win, right? That's kind of the undertext, subtext of those types of things. I run a race. I'm talking to my friends. The first thing they want to know is how did it go? Well, they don't mean did I, like, have fun and enjoy the experience. They mean, like, performance wise. How did it go? And we do that for runners. It's that, like, did you hit your goal, right? Well, did you do the thing you wanted to do? We're always careful about asking questions of performance to each other because we don't know exactly what the goal was. But as soon as we know what the goal was, the question is, well, did you do it? Did you hit it? Interestingly enough, in most sports, running aside, in nearly every sport, half of the people who compete in a game win. Half. You know, you think about it, it's two teams, two individuals often. Well, it depends, but a lot of sports are still two individuals as well. In most sports, half of the people who compete every time, every instance of competition, win. Well, that's a wonderful thing because in running, it's not even close. Remember Dathan? This goes back to, like, one of the first episodes on our podcast. Dathan Ritzenhain was on. He was generous enough to share a number of different thoughts in running. And one of the things that he said, he's like, most people never win a race. Most runners never win. In fact, in most races, fewer than 0.1% of runners win. So in football, every single game, half the people win. In running races, 0.1%. Like, we are really comfortable with the idea of not winning. Now, that's aside, because most of us are not trying to win. That's not really the kind of win when we're defining. We're really trying to achieve some other kind of performance goal most of the time. And even then, most of the time, most people are not achieving that goal. They're not winning in that sense. That makes for a really challenging consideration when we say the goal is to win and we understand so much losing happens. And I'm speaking tongue in cheek on purpose. So that brings up then the question, as the author continues to unpack this a bit, well, what does it mean to play for a higher purpose, to compete for a higher purpose, to do the thing? One of the examples that O'Sullivan gives is attaching a cause to the endeavor. And we certainly as runners see a lot of this, the charity associations, the raising money based on the things that I'm doing or the results, or just raising money to feature that, you know, thing. And so That's good. That's really valuable stuff. And there's a lot of different opportunities for ways to do that. I like that function of the World Marathon Majors, that there's a charity piece to it. You can get an entry to a race if you raise so much money for some charitable organization. I think that's a wonderful thing. That's good. But let's continue down more examples and get some other senses of what they're talking about here. So one of the comments here, by the way, directly in the text was outcome aware, but purpose and process driven, as a way to think about, okay, I am thinking about these goals, these outcomes, but I'm not driven solely by them. Purpose and process, which is, now we're adding another layer to it. So let's get some examples here. The first one that the author shared was Messiah College, because as a Division III NCAA school, it's the winningest soccer program combined men's and women's in NCAA history to date at that time. I don't know exactly when the author was referring to it. The year wasn't listed there, but in the early 2000s. And we're talking about like winning most of the national championships, most of them between the men and the women. Like the only school to have the men and the women win, you know, the same national championship. And they did it like four times. So lots of that. There's a book then that one of the professors of the school published specifically about, their approach. And they have these seven disciplines. And the first discipline number one is pursue a higher purpose than winning. That, author, by the way, is Michael Zigarelli. So, this idea of there's more going on here, not just like lip service to things, but like defining how we do the thing we do and why we do it. So here's a quote from one of the soccer coaches from their program history, Scott Frey. And I really, this one really struck me. So I'm actually going to read it directly from the book for you here. So Frey said, in a letter written to the women's soccer team, to his players at the end of the season, or rather, this was a letter written to the team during the season. If at the end of your career, Frey wrote, all you can say is, I was a national champion and we won a lot of games, then I'd say it wasn't worth the time or energy. But if you can look back and say, I learned a lot about myself. I did things I never thought possible, both physically and psychologically. I made the most important and lasting friendships of my life. I've learned that helping others and seeing them succeed at something is better than it happening to me. Then it is without question worth all that you do. That's Frey. That is something. And it sounds hokey, right? It feels hokey when we, like, it's one of those things like the rah-rah speech from the coach and we're like, yeah, sure, but really you just care about winning the game. You know, it's like it has that kind of that feeling to it. But at the same time, I understand the sentiment that the coach is trying to convey when he said to the athletes, if all I say is I was a national champion and won a lot of games, then it's not worth it. Because you talk to people and there's this reflection that happens, and I can share many instances of this reflection personally. I don't know how many of you would relate to it too, but it's like I look back on the thing and it's like I hit that big goal. Like I achieved this huge monumental thing that I've been aspiring to achieve, and I just feel so good about it. But then like looking back on it, it's like, but also it didn't really make a difference. It was great. It was cool and I enjoyed it, but what difference really did that make in my life? It just was this thing that I wanted so badly and I got it. And then it didn't change my life in any way. That's kind of the sense that we're getting here. But there are things that do have some other kind of serious meaningfulness and fulfillment. And what are those and how do we aspire toward them? So that's the Messiah College example. There's some interesting comments about that further on too. But there's another one here then that comes from UNC, North Carolina. They call it the Carolina Way, by the way. There's like this thing they call the Carolina Way. And you get this, you know, colleges do this like way over the top where they're trying to like create this sense, you're like you're a part of a sense of something that's bigger than yourself. But in practice, like, is it actually happening and what does it look like when it's happening? Well, the UNC team, why this is relevant, at the time that this text was written, they had won 22 of 24 national title bids. That's a serious amount of winning and a serious win percentage. As a matter of fact, the comment from the coach is, what kind of program has a better win percentage in the national championships than in the regular season? Like, they win more times in the national championships than they do generally throughout other times. That's really good. Okay, so here's one of the practices of the team, one of the things that the coach did, or maybe still does, that this is so cool. So the coach writes a letter to every senior on the team in their championship game at the end of the season. A personal letter, something about like the how they have contributed to the success of the program and the legacy they're leaving behind, things like that. You know, really, really great stuff. But then, so the coach hands a letter, a copy of each letter to each of those seniors as they exit the locker room. I don't know when this is, like the day before or the day of the game. I don't know. But then after the seniors exit, the coach then reads aloud each of the letters to the rest of the team. And it's the conversation about this is, we're doing this for all of this. And that's really cool. I really like that. That's a great idea. Anyone listening who's a coach, think about that. That's a great idea. So this is just really an illustration of that we create a sense of meaningfulness and purpose. And it's not the winning the game that was the thing that really mattered. It was something else there. So let's keep talking about that something else. Performance character versus moral character. This is another section in the chapter that I just found to be really interesting. So why purpose beyond just the achievement? Why that connects so deeply is because there's some kind of connection to this idea of moral character. Contrast that with what the author calls performance character, and that's what he says research terms it winning values. And that quote is the mental, emotional, and behavioral attributes that drive performance in an achievement activity. Those are winning values. That's like grit, self-discipline, resilience. These are good things, but contrast that with then the moral character, which is stuff like integrity and respect and that kind of stuff. And you can see, like, one has, they have two different kinds of impact, right? And this is why, this is where I'm starting to get fascinated with the connection for us. The one kind of impact is like me and my personal development, which can certainly be valuable to others in terms of like an example, a model, or even just, my capacity to be for others a good thing. But contrast that with moral character. And what we find in these moral character values that the author is explaining is these are things that have to do with how we live in a community and interact with each other. And immediately I saw that delineation, and the author doesn't really differentiate that directly in that sense, but I saw that delineation and I thought there is something really important here. Because when we think about what creates greater fulfillment and meaning in our purpose for doing something, it's hard to see a highly meaningful and fulfilling thing that doesn't somehow connect to people outside of ourselves. So here's what I want to do. I want to spend a few minutes trying to find this connection in a practical sense. So what does this have to do with runners? Because this author is writing predominantly about team sports, as you might guess, and especially about youth sports. And so what about like our individual adult runners who are just kind of doing our own thing because, you know, that's the nature of how this thing functions in running? Well, I think there's something here. And I wonder first, what would we say to the question of like, why do I do this? And how much of that is a conscious effort, like something I'm deliberately aspiring toward with the way I go about what I'm doing or decisions I make in terms of how I'm doing things, when I'm doing things, and with whom and such. And then also, in the same sense, how is that purpose reflected in the way we win or lose when we achieve or not achieve? And so that's where I want to kind of try to sit on that a little bit. So goals we desire to achieve, purpose that undergirds our efforts, colors how we pursue our goals. There's some connection between these things. And Honestly, the title of the episode here, "Don't Achieve Goals, Find Purpose." That's actually kind of a bait, because I think that there's a combination. These things are involved with each other a bit, and so I don't want to be too extreme, as I have often been in the past with this concept. I think it is valuable to have achievement goals and such, but process as a piece of that is important. And that was one of the takeaways from the author, that the way we do it and how we go about it is an important aspect, if not the most important aspect, of the achievement side, as well as involved in the purpose side. If I put on my blinders, which Zach is prone to do, as you know, if I put on my blinders and I just do this thing day in, day out, others, you know, whatever costs it is to others, my family, my friends, or otherwise, I'm aspiring toward, you know, my own endeavors, and I'm ignoring all else, that kind of thing. That's not sustainable, for one thing, but also that's not very enriching for me. So there's a concern in that. So I see then, what does it look like if I'm encouraging and supporting others in my efforts, or how am I using the things that I'm doing in a manner that are beyond myself? And this is where I always get into. So this is the connection then back to the Olympic trials again. There was a question on the athlete bio forms that they were going to then publish on the websites that said something about your greatest accomplishment. It's the classic question, right? What's your greatest accomplishment? And every time I get that question, I want to be snarky. And forgive me for my snarkiness. But the reason I want to be snarky is because I hear that question and I think, what does it matter? And I know I'm being extreme in that, but also it immediately reminds me of, and I put this even in the athlete bio on the Olympic Trials website, it reminds me of Ecclesiastes. If you're familiar with that book from the Old Testament of the Bible, Ecclesiastes is the book, the classic morose text about, like, all is vanity. What does it matter? What have I done? You know, I've gained all these things. And the author writes in the book, I've gained so much wisdom. I've gained so much riches. I have grown my value and property and all this stuff. I've done so many great things. I have all these friends, you know, it's like all this stuff, right? And it's all vanity. and it's all blowing with the wind. And that's kind of the extent of, like, chapters and chapters of text. But then there's this big conclusion, and this is really poignant to me at the moment. In the text in particular, the author writes, this is in the final chapter of the book, I think it's like the second to last verse of the final chapter of the book, second to last sentence. "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." And I sit on that and I think, why is that the response to all of this? Like, everything, nothing matters. So just fear God and keep his commandments. The reason why this is standing out to me right now in this context is because I don't know the intent, the author's intent there, but I see in this, in particular, in this historical context and in this spiritual context, the commandments referenced here by the author are nearly all about how to treat other people. And so if you go back and you read Old Testament texts about the commandments, whether it's like the classic Ten Commandments or the many other less, I guess you could say, minor commandments, although you don't want to belittle that in that sense. But if that's the case, it's like all about how to treat other people. And it's like, you know, don't kill people, don't steal people, don't covet things that other people have. And so that is really interesting. Because if the answer to the all is vanity and nothing, what does it matter? Nothing new under the sun. Everyone's done it already. And I'm just like one more of these random, you know, motes in the wind. And yet, the thing that makes the most difference, and in terms of, like, the thing that fulfills our purpose, has a lot to do. I'm not saying this is solely at the center of it, but has a lot to do with how we treat other people. This, in the same connection to the author's text here, this is the same essence that the author gives in Every Moment Matters, that John O'Sullivan gives about moral character. It has to do with what is beyond ourselves and interacting with other people. And I think that this is so important as we look for purpose in something as simple as running. And the reason why I think this is so important is because it has the potential to take a thing that feels like, I'm just doing this because it's healthy and I want to be healthy. I like to be fit. I want to be fast. I want to achieve this goal, which those are good things of themselves. But it takes it to a greater sense of whatever the thing is that I'm doing, I can fulfill a meaningful purpose. And it isn't complicated. And I think that's the important part. It's not like some great grand aspiration. It's not complicated. You can go back to the Ecclesiastes text, just, fear God and keep his commandments. That's actually not complicated. Well, difficult and complicated are not the same thing. But whatever the case may be, the lesson here that I'm taking away is there is something that we can do here that can move this sense of, like, I have goals, but I also have purpose in the thing that I'm doing. And why am I spending all this time? And I can find ways, and it's not like one single purpose that's defining all the things all the time, but I can find ways in a moment to see that kind of a purpose in the things that I'm doing. So here's what I want to do. First, actually, let me just say, this reminds me, part of the reason why this stands out to me is because it reminds me of things that you all say to us when we're interacting in social medias or when we're talking in person. Things we constantly hear are the stories, and you know this as well, the stories about how some person helped or inspired me. Like, I'm in the race and it was so great to have this person to run with, and we talked and we encouraged each other, or I was driven because someone was, next to me was just really having a hard time but trying to stick through it, and so we were helping each other out. Like, all that stuff, right? There's so much of that, and there's many different examples that are not exactly that, but those types of things. So I want to finish this then by saying, finish my reflection here, hokey as it may seem and sound, by rewriting Scott Frey's words in more runner speak, and just simply for us to dwell on what could this look like for me, and or what does it look like for me. I'm not suggesting that you're not already involved in this kind of thinking and the way you do things, but I haven't been many times in my life, and so I'm contemplating whether I can find better ways to be so. So here's the quote rewritten in runner speak and in my own words, taking some of his and some of mine. If at the end of the year, all I can say is I ran 2,000 miles and a 10-minute PR to qualify for the big race, then I'd say it wasn't worth the energy. But if instead I can say I worked hard when it wasn't fun, encouraged others even when I was having a bad day, I helped a stranger across the finish line, devoted time and thought and prayer to the betterment of others, or celebrated others' successes more than my own, then it is without question worth all that you do. So, to close it out, finding ways of things like that. And if you've got some, and you've got some thoughts, and I know that you do because you share them with us, we'd love to hear more about why you do these things and how you find and experience meaningfulness and fulfillment in this running stuff that you do. So with that, let's get on now to the world of running. All right, well, I guess I should at least just slightly apologize. When Andy's not here, Zach just like goes on these soapbox tirades. And so I hope you don't feel like Zach's trying to preach down your throat or anything like that. It's more we're fascinated by these important things and looking for connections to the stuff we do, like running. Well, one connection is we really enjoy knowing about your successes and celebrating them with you. And one of the things we try to do to illustrate that point is with the runners that we particularly work with, we like to be able to share with you the things that they do and their successes. That's why we do this every single week in the world of running. We start by sharing any of the successes and experiences that our runners have been involved in lately. And certainly glad to hear from many of you. Often you share with us things that you've done And it's been exciting to hear that. So continue to do so. This in particular, most recently, Martha had run a 5K in one of those like winter freezing, you know, ice race types of things. And it was her first in a long time. And so with many disruptions and various reasons with training stuff that took a while to come back from some things, and ended up having a stronger than anticipated day, which is always really exciting, and just was able to get out and do it, which was one of the big blocks previously, was just, you know, trying to make sure that she could do the thing, feel ready and confident in it, I guess is a better point, get through some of those disruptions. And she finally was able to, and it was just really cool. So well done, Martha. Very exciting stuff. All right. Number one on our list here, we're going to start with some really exciting things, and then there are some really tragic things here to share as well. But starting with the exciting, Millrose Games is one of the premier indoor track meets in the world, held in New York City at the Armory. And this one was did not disappoint. So it's the case that right now in indoor track and field, it seems like every meet they're touting the world record attempts that are happening at their meet. Like, it's just the norm now lately in the last couple of years. Well, apparently in every single event, someone was like, yeah, we're going to set a world record in this one now. Not exactly happening, but that seemed to be like what everyone was talking about. So in the women's 2 mile, things were super exciting, but they started really weird and disappointing for Medina Aissa in particular, of Ethiopia, because at the start of the race, she clearly, they have this thing called a waterfall start and track, which means the start line is like a curved line. It's not the straight line across the track. And you all just line up all the way across the track. And then when the gun goes off, you can go as fast as you want, you know, try to get into lane one right away. You don't have to like stay in a lane or anything. That's the classic distance race start. That's the norm. Now, in some occasions when there's too many people for the track size or various other things, they have then what they call a double waterfall start, where you have the first waterfall at the regular start line and then up a ways and like four lanes over on the track, or three lanes depending on the track size, you have another waterfall start. And then in the second waterfall, you have to stay in what they call your alley until a certain point, usually demarcated by cones. And then when you get to those cones, you can then cut all the way into the interior of the track, lane one. So that's normal if you're familiar with racing, especially indoor track, in particular in races with lots of people. So this does not happen in lots of places. Like, they just don't use double waterfall starts in a lot of places, or alley starts at all or anything like that for distance events. And the solution is you just don't put too many people in a heat. You have multiple heats instead, things like that. Well, in the United States, we use double waterfalls a fair bit in indoor track, but many other places in the world don't ever, hardly. And so Medina Aissa from Ethiopia, very young on the scene. She's a teenager. She's new to the scene of running in some senses, although she's been world-class since she was even a younger teenager. But point is, she clearly was not grasping what they were trying to have her do at the start. She goes up to the start line and she's like in the wrong lane. They had to move her back over. But it's confusing. And I can't help but wonder if the reason it's confusing to her is because she's just never started in a situation like that. And so she, as soon as the gun goes off, though she's in the second waterfall, jumps right into the interior lanes, not quite into lane one, but very nearly. And it's clear that she's just a little bit confused there. And so she gets disqualified. Major bummer, especially because she ended up winning the race. They didn't pull her off the race. She finished it, won the race, and then later found out she was disqualified. So lots of people had a lot of things to say about that on the message boards. As you might guess, the comment section is never a place you want to dwell for too long. But my only comment to that is very unfortunate. And yes, she had to be DQ'd because she broke the rules. But the meet people, the officials in the meet, should not have done that. They had other options. Like at the beginning, it was clear that she was having a hard time and confused. Just put her on the first waterfall. That's all it takes is, okay, she doesn't understand English. I don't know if at all or just not very well, but you're not going to be able to explain it to her without someone translating, I'm guessing, very easily. So solve the problem by just putting her in the first waterfall. Problem solved. Okay, anyway, that's my beef. That's all I've got to say. Okay, now, Laura Muir then took full advantage. Well, not took advantage. She didn't even know until after. But Laura Muir was best of the rest. And in one of her classic, very strong final kicks, wins the race in number two all-time world performance. British record, 904.8 for the two-mile run. Just an incredible run by Laura Muir. Amazing effort. And really showed her stuff, you know, on a distance that's not really her forte. She spends most of her time in the 800 and the mile ranges. So behind her then in second place was teenager Melknot Wudu of Ethiopia. Recall a week ago she set the world under 20 record in the 3,000 meters. Well, she did it again in the 2 mile this time, and number four all time in the world in her performance of 907. And so Medina Ayisa, by the way, would have had that record because she also is in that age group, if not for the disqualification. So Wudu, number four all time, crazy impressive as a teenager at that. And then back in third place, Alicia Munson of the United States, who did most of the work late in the race after the pacers dropped out. She just kind of took the front and grinded it out. Grounded out? Well, anyway, she ended up with a world number five performance and an American record, 909.7. Alicia Munson now holds like four American records. Let's keep counting them because she's just continuing to do it. Very impressive stuff. And then back in fifth place, by the way, Nozomi Tanaka of Japan set a national record as well in 916.76. So all around, lots of records dropped there. Really exciting stuff. And that was just the first one to share. Then in the men's 2 mile run, which might have been like the most exciting event of the meet in terms of anticipation, Josh Kerr 2 months ago said he was going to attempt the world record in this distance. 2 months ago. Well, he did attempt it. And he succeeded. So Josh Kerr from Great Britain, world champion in the 1500 meters last summer, goes on to now break a world record in the 2 mile indoors. They call it the short track because it is in fact a shorter track. But he ran an impressive race with a very strong finish. Wanted world record pace. He got it, and he did it. And it was really something. Eight flat, by the way. Eight flat point six. So just narrowly missing a sub eight performance, which has never been done indoors, of course, and only a couple of times outdoors. Grant Fisher from the United States was all about it with this world record attempt. He not only ran with Josh Kerr, but he was actually the one driving it until just the final 600 meters. So Fisher took over after the pacers dropped, and he just held the grind. And in fact, that was his race plan all along. He thought, you know what, I'm going to go for this record too. And the best way to beat the likes of Josh Kerr, who's a famous kicker, is to drive the pace hard from far out. And so for the whole last mile, Fisher's just going at it. Together, they ended up finishing 4 minutes for Fisher and 3:57 second mile for Josh Kerr. So really impressive stuff. Grant Fisher definitely had a good race in him, just didn't have that final kick. And so then he went on to finish second and a new American record time as well, dropping a fair bit off of it. And here's the point. The first four guys across the line in this race all finished in the top 10 all time in the world. So Josh Kerr, new world record. Grant Fisher, number three all-time performance. And only 0.2 of a second off the previous world record. So he was right there. He was doing it, but Kerr just beat him to it. And then in third place, Cole Hocker of the United States was number six all-time in the world with his performance of 8:05. And by the way, also under the previous American record. So two guys in one race bested that previous record that was held by Galen Rupp. And then in fourth place, Gordy Beamish from New Zealand ran number seven all-time performance in a New Zealand national record, I believe. Yeah, New Zealand national record in 8:05. So we have two national records and a world record, four top 10 all-time performances just in one race. Well, in the women's mile, things were exciting there too, because Ellie St. Pierre and Jessica Hull got their rematch last weekend. They ran against each other in the 3,000 meters in an astounding performance. Jessica Hull bested St. Pierre in the final moments of the race to run an Australian national record. Well, this time around, St. Pierre got her revenge and demonstrated that she's been working on her weaknesses, because she has not been known as a phenomenal kicker, but she had the late race strong finish this time around over Jessica Hull. So St. Pierre wins the race in a number three all-time performance in the world number three performance of 4:16, bettering her own American record. So yes, an American record again in the victory in the race, even though she also held it previously. And then Jessica Hull behind her set a new Australian national record for the number 10 performance all time in the world, running 4:19. And it just keeps going. In third place, Susan Ijori of Kenya set a new national record, running 4:20. Fourth place, Yolanda Ngarambe set a new Swedish national record in 4:23. Sixth place, Marta Perez of Spain, national record 4:23. And in eighth, Harvard's Maya Ramsden. You'll recall she was the NCAA champion in the 1500 meters last year. She almost broke Caitlin Tui's collegiate record, very nearly. By the way, after racing in the distance medley relay to run the mile anchor leg for Harvard's DMR team, which she did in a totally different location. So she ran the relay the day before, drove down to New York from Boston, drove to New York from Boston and then ran very nearly a collegiate record. That's just amazing. Maya Ramsden, great to watch. Exciting to see her continue to grow. All right, so you got that. All those national records in the women's mile. Didn't miss it. Now, the men's mile was another one touted as a world record attempt. Who was attempting the world record in the indoor mile? Yared Nuguse. Again, remember he attempted it last year. Missed it by like 0.4 of a second. Maybe 0.3 of a second. Well, he tried it again this year. And he missed it again this year, but it was yet again by a narrow margin. So first, the first four across the line once again all finished in the top 10 all time in the world. We're talking about four guys, one race, top 10 ever in world history in the indoor mile. Who are those? Well, in fourth place was Adam Fogg. That's a name that you probably have not heard us mention much on the podcast, because Adam Fogg has just been improving by leaps and bounds right now, and it's really exciting. He's British, and he finished number 9 all-time by running 3:49.6. That is so fast. Third place was George Mills of Great Britain, and finished number 6 all-time in the world with his 3:48.9 performance. Then in second place was the United States' Hobbs Kessler, the youngster who's just having this dramatic improvement lately, which we've mentioned as well. And Hobbs Kessler, number 4 all-time, ran 3:48 as well. And that means leaves Yared Nuguse first place, the first in quite a while to defend his Wanamaker Mile title. He won this race last year, won it again this year, and ran 4:47 and change again for the number 2 all-time performance. It was number 3 next to his own performance, but the point is he is the number 2 all-time performance, and he's the only guy who has ever run under 3:48 more than once in an indoor mile. Now there's something for you. The only one. Well, as it goes, the race was actually just kind of a straightforward time trial. You had a pacer. The pacer went out fast. Nuguse ran right behind him, and as soon as he dropped off, Nuguse just kept going. Actually, he slowed down a little bit, which is why he didn't get the world record, but we're not judging him because he was running so fast the whole time. They came through the first 800 meters in like 1:52. That's so fast. Way too fast. Well, Nuguse kept on, but it was actually George Mills from Great Britain in the bell lap with 200 meters to go. The bell rings and Mills starts trying to go for the pass, but Nuguse didn't want to give it up. And so he put on the pressure and in fact just ran away from him. And it was George Mills and Hobbs Kessler who had been trailing Neguse at the time. They were right on him, but Neguse's last 200 meters broke them all, and he broke away for the victory. Hobbs Kessler, however, resurged around George Mills to then take second. He says, you know, it was a bummer that he didn't hang right on Neguse and keep Mills off his back. Instead, Mills got around him because he thinks he might have had a better chance at the victory, in fact, which is really something. But Hobbs Kessler still went on to finish number four all time to run 3:48, and the mile. This kid is really moving on up. Really cool stuff. By the way, Adam Fogg, who I mentioned fourth in the race, he was slightly detached the whole time, but he was the guy who, when the pacer dropped out and Yard Neguse started kind of slowing it down a little bit, Adam Fogg's the guy who saw that and went after him, started chasing him down. And that's just really bold move. When you're, he was in the chase pack, he was behind him, but then he started like reeling him in. Really impressive stuff, especially for the third 400 meters of a mile, which is the worst moment in any human's life. Maybe that's dramatic. So props to Fogg. That was awesome. They call him the Fogg Dog. There he goes. All right. Side note, the last person to win two times in a row this event, the Wanamaker Mile at Millrose Games, was Matthew Centrowitz. And Matthew Centrowitz did that in the year 2016. And then later on in the year 2016, Matthew Centrowitz went on to win the Olympic gold medal in the 1500 meters. So I don't know, Neguse, this is an Olympic year. Maybe we got the makings of a repeat kind of thing. We'll see. We'll see. Neguse has certainly got his eyes set on that Olympic race. Major takeaway for me, more world-class runners are running indoor track, which is just, it's just not been a common thing historically. Opportunity and accessibility, among other things. But as it were, with more opportunities, with more major events happening, this is why we're seeing so many of these records falling now. Among all the other reasons, you know, there's certainly records falling all over the place across the board. But the indoor records are the softer ones for sure. And they are dropping like lead sinkers, as I said in the intro. Well, let's move on to the next one. This one, then, let's jump across the pond to France and the Levin meet, if I'm saying that correctly. This one is just as likely to see record attempt performances. It's a common theme at the meet. Well, in the women's 3,000 meters, Gudaf Sige of Ethiopia, who holds the 5,000-meter world record and something else, she announced she was going to attempt the 3,000-meter world record indoors. And yet again, after having attempted it last year at this meet, just barely missed it once more. Last year, she missed it by under 1/10 of a second. This year, she missed it by 5/10 of a second. That's just rough. That is just so close. Keeps missing it. By the way, one of her pacers, I just found this fascinating, was 16 years old. I would never do that at 16 years old. When I was 16 years old, just the horror of the responsibility of pacing world-class athletes at a world record attempt. Now, granted, they had wave lights for this race, so all the pacer has to do is just follow the lights. But it's still, that's a lot of pressure. Really cool. Good composure. All right. Dominant win by Sige, even though she missed the world record. Women's 1500 meters at the meet, Freweni Hailu of Ethiopia has been on a rampage. She's just winning all the stuff. And she is a serious threat in championship races because she has the best kick. I've said this many times. I think Faith Kipyegon last summer had the best kick in history in women's middle distance running. Aside from Faith Kipyegon last summer, nobody outkicks Freweni Hailu when she is at her best in a kick. That's my opinion, based on what she does. So it's no surprise that she keeps winning races because it's really hard to beat her. But that said, this is her third victory in 10 days. She's been racing a lot, and I expect we'll probably see her at the World Indoor Championships, which are in 2 weeks, depending on when you're listening to this. So coming up soon, the first weekend of March. Men's 3,000 meters, by the way, Solomon Barrega, looking strong this season, ran a world-leading time 5 days ago, and then ran, or 5 days before this meet, and then ran again and still won another race. So he's just winning lots of races in short proximity, which is cool. But behind him, Biniam Meheri of Ethiopia, another teenager, set a new world U20 record in the 1500 several days before, and then goes on to run number three on that U20 list for the 3,000. Only a handful of days. The guy turns 18. He's 17 years old. He turns 18 in December of 2024. Because if he turned 18 a month later, then this time would have been a major U18 record as well. So this guy's someone to watch. Ethiopian Biniam Meheri. And then in the men's 2,000 meters, Lameche Girma, who is the current world record holder of the indoor 3,000, he had announced he was attempting the 2,000 meter record, but he did miss it by a couple of seconds. Good for world number two. And it should be noted, he did actually attempt his own 3,000 record last weekend, and that didn't go super well either. Couple of other notable things, not in this meet in France, just other meets other places. At the BU Valentine meet, which was on February 9th, 43 men ran under 4 minutes in the mile at one meet. 43. That is a lot. Very impressive stuff. You're going to see more and more of that kind of stuff, certainly. In Seattle, Stanford's Kai Robinson ran the number two collegiate time in the 3,000 meters. He missed the collegiate record by 0.25 seconds. So Kai Robinson, looking strong. He is, as you recall, the 2023 5,000 and 10,000 meter double champion in the outdoor NCAA championships. And then elsewhere, the Australian youth stud, we've talked about him before, Cameron Myers. He's now 17 years old. He ran 3:34 in a 1,500 meters. That's like a 3:51 mile, okay? And he's 17 years old, and that's his first race of the season. This kid, he's run a little bit faster than that, but that's his first race of the season. That's amazing. And another Australian youth on the girls' side, Claudia Hollingsworth, also one to watch, ran an outstanding performance when she won the girls' race in 4:04 for the 1,500 meters. And once again, that's equivalent to a low 4:20s mile. We're talking about some of the fastest people in, like, ever at these ages. This is incredible to see. That was, by the way, an Australian youth record for Hollingsworth for Claudia. All right. We got to talk about Calvin Kiptum. You've heard the news, I'm guessing, because it's all over the place right now. And tragically, Calvin Kiptum, who holds the marathon world record, bested Kipchoge's record, died in a car accident along with his coach on February 11th, Sunday, February 11th. Terrible story here, and as the news was circulating, lots of condolences and well wishes from everyone, which is wonderful to see the running people trying to get behind, you know, just trying to support the family and those who survived him. Kiptum was without doubt the most promising distance runner in the world presently, after winning London and then Chicago and like his first couple of marathons he's ever run, among his first couple of marathons he's ever run, and then setting the world record in Chicago in 2 hours and 35 seconds. He had talked about he was going to be the first to run under 2 hours in a legit marathon, records legal marathon. No one doubted that he was going to do that. It was more a question of just when. And now it's all over. And I guess this kind of, in some kind of reflection, kind of brings us full circle to say, you know, there's a sense, there's a feeling of like, what's it all for? You know, at the end of the day, Calvin Kiptum, there's a lot more to Calvin Kiptum than that time. And there should be a lot more to the things we aspire toward than, you know, to achieve some goal. And so, you know, our hearts go out to Kiptum and his family and friends now who are grieving. And there's a sense in the running community in general that there's a loss there, as always. And it doesn't require, you know, major accomplishments and accolades, you know, personal accomplishments and accolades for the running world to feel a loss, you know, when someone, you could say, prematurely dies. But as it were, this is a tragic moment, and we know that it does happen. It's happened, in fact, in the recent past. Another of the marathon greats died in his youth, you could say. And so we hope for comfort with the survivors, and certainly now at this point in time, thinking about, you know, nothing about running changes as a result, but the nature of what's coming, you know, in the future now has a little bit of a difference to it as a result. So with all of that, as we're reflecting on deep and substantial things, and we like to do that from time to time here at A to Z Running, we also really, as you know, want to hear from you and hear your thoughts. And so share your questions. You can send the email questions@azrunning.com or comments on the places. We're on YouTube. We're on Spotify. We're on Instagram. And we love to hear your thoughts and see your interactions in those places as well. With that, thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. And we look forward to talking with you again next week.